I'll tell you one interesting thing. We published a book of Chinese koan stories in 2003, I think. The koan stories, 301, were collected by Dogen. They're all written in Chinese. And he used them as some of the material in his lectures that he gave, which were recorded in Chenzhou. So in this book of 301 koan stories, a lot of those stories appear in the Shobogenzo in the commentaries. He talks about the story and then discusses it. So they're quite interesting stories. He didn't comment on the stories in his collection. He just collected 301. My teacher dictated commentaries at various times, and we gradually pieced it all together and made a book. And the interesting thing is, these 301 stories are kind of teaching devices. But they're not explicit. They're just stories. Master so-and-so said to Master so-and-so, so-and-so. And then Master so-and-so answered so-and-so. And so on. So they're quite clearly stories that illustrate teachings. But in none of them is there any statement of general principle. And this is a very clear illustration of the difference between 10th, 11th, 12th century China and modern society. These stories are just simple stories that illustrate principles without being explicit about the principles. Whereas in the modern age, we prefer the principles to the story. And if we hear the story, if we hear one story, it's fine. If we hear two, we want to make a generalization. If we hear three, we want to set down principles. And it's this tendency to generalize that is at the root of what we were arguing about this morning. We have a need to generalize. I don't know why. To find something in common between two or more things. And that which is in common is abstract. So you wouldn't have two stories where about masters where you said, oh, there's a general principle between these two masters. They both wear brown robes. You might say, oh, there's a general principle between these two masters. They both believe so-and-so. I haven't got any stories to quote. But if you want to read the book, it's you can buy it on the web. But it seems quite clear to me that in 10th, 11th, 12th century China and Japan, they didn't need to make general principles. Just to read a story and then to read another story, just to read illustrations or to hear illustrations of a principle was enough. And in some way they internalized a generalization from that. Whereas we're exactly the opposite. we need to find the general rule straight away. That's not really very clear, is it? I wish I could illustrate it a bit more.
I don't know why, but it seems that's how we are taught, right? Because when a small child go to reception, to preschool or whatever, the first test they do is like given 4 or 5 objects.
Yeah.
And the child is asked to find
something
common about them, or to find one which doesn't belong to the group.
Yeah.
Is it? I don't know. Is it the same?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's.
Yes. Well, it's perfect.
Yeah, and it's like, from the age of 5, we are taught to put things into categories. This doesn't belong here,
yes,
because it's not round. This belongs, these 3 objects belongs here because they all made from wood. That's how we are taught from every ages. So of course, that's why when we were talking about chopping wood and singing, you know, so we were thinking, this is chore, this is pleasure. So we put it into the category of chore, because that's how we make money. So for us, it's pretty much the same thing. Under the same umbrella of chores, jobs, making living. Whereas sitting is from opposite category, that's something we are doing for spiritual growth, for grounding ourselves from whatever, but it's a different category, right?
Yeah.
Right? So, yeah, and I see now your point very clearly, that it's only a very artificial way of defining things. And you can,
it is in a way, yes, it, because we lose sight of the actual things in themselves.
Yeah.
We forget.
It wasn't obvious at all when we just started this. Okay, what's it? They're just like, what are you talking about? Why saving mail is bad and chopping wood is good?
No, I didn't say bad or good.
Yeah, I know, but that's how it
comes. Yeah.
Why are they from different?
So I don't know what it must have been like in 10th century China, or how people thought. It's beyond me to really guess. Well, I can guess, but it's beyond me to know. But in some way, they didn't have that need.
I wonder if it is purely because of simple volume of information, which
maybe
around. Yeah, but clearly we are exposed to more.
We're exposed to more, but we have a strong urge to categorize and generalize.
I think it started with intelligence tests. It started with, they were looking for intelligence tests that were non-language specific.
Okay.
So I think they started doing tests with, do these things belong or do they not belong? And then they started teaching it in schools, because otherwise the kids couldn't do well in the tests. I remember seeing it in Sesame Street. It's singing the song.
Good. Because these things is not like the other ones.
That's right.
Yes.
Really?
Yeah.
Yes.
Wow.
The Indian Buddhism seems to be absolutely crammed with categories. Is that right?
Oh, that's true, isn't it? Yes.
So that
maybe it's maybe I'm mistaken.
Well, I mean, I guess something happened to transform it.
I've been reading a book on Chinese Zen Buddhism and how it came from India to China. And it said, like, at the time, the Chinese, because it's so complicated, like the Indian Buddhism.
Yeah.
And they had to, like, simplify everything because they couldn't comprehend everything because it was so complicated. And
yeah.
I think it's, yeah, maybe at the very beginning, they started to simplify everything to make it easier for people to understand.
Okay.
Because they just couldn't get it. There were just like so many branches and all these things going on. But that's from the book I was reading, and they were talking about the history of how it evolved. So I think maybe they simplified it for the sake of the Chinese people. Because it's a very different way of thinking.
Yes. In a strange way, that different way of thinking it's quite helpful if we can grasp it. That is to notice that when we generalize and categorize things, we lose the distinction between them, the real distinction between those things. So like a big lump of wood and a small lump of wood, they're both lumps of wood, but one's much bigger than the other, so that they're actually different. A big lump of wood is different from a small lump of wood.
Part of it is using language in itself, though, isn't it?
Yes.
If you name something,
yes,
then you have categorised.
Yes.
So, without naming, without wanting so much to name things,
yes,
you might find it easier.
Okay. We can't help naming them.
I was certainly talked to.
We're taught to. It's only a comment, really.
I might not have been alone in thinking I'd misunderstood you when you were talking, when you said that chopping was different from sending emails. I thought you meant it's different, i.e. there are different categories, which I now see is completely not what you meant. And it was that I thought was, I was thrown by.
Yeah, it took us all a while to actually get
to it. I see you're making an incredibly simple point, which I think...
Incredibly simple point.
Which we all overcomplicated, you know.
It's just that I thought might have said there are different categories. That was all, but that's completely not what you're saying. So.
Okay.
In artificial intelligence, there are two kinds of models. There's white box and black box. And then, like 10 years ago, white box were popular, where you give it 1,000 of examples and it finds out rules, and actually has explicit rules which are there in the system, and it tells you why it made every decision. And then nowadays, the black box is more popular. It just makes decisions and can't tell why it made this decision, but it learned it.
So you don't know what's in the box.
You don't know what's in the box at all. It's a black box. It's
but
not transparent.
You can.
But it does much better. Like the performance of it is much better than the rules ones. Maybe in 10 years, they'll learn how to do good rules and we'll come back to rule system. It sort of alternates the development between white box and black box systems. But it's kind of a disadvantage if you don't know why the system made this decision. Like, why did they make the mistake?
Well, if you can map the output to the input, then you're okay then.
But you don't know how to fix it.
Oh, I see.
Like, I can give it more of the examples where it makes mistakes. Maybe it will learn it, but what is the category where it makes mistakes? So I have to find this category, define it myself, and then make it learn more that way. So it's really hard to diagnose it. It just becomes like a dark art, how to tune the systems, just from experience and learning. Rather than, if there are rules, then it's much easier. Oh, it made this mistake because of this rule. I should fix that rule.
Is that why we are taught this way? Because then it's easier to manipulate society.
Mm-hmm.
If society makes mistake, you know how to fix it.
I don't know why, but it's much more comforting to live. Like, I live this way because I have these ethical rules, and I operate by them because, you know, I'm a machine. Everything is going to be fine. I follow the rules. But I don't follow the rules. I do what my pinky wants me to do. I'm a human being, not a logical.
Do you do what your thinking wants you to do?
Pinky.
Pinky.
What does your pinky want you to do?
Well, it's an expression. I mean, like, I'm not a rational creature, that's what I'm saying.
Oh.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
Yeah.
entirely sure understand what you. I'm entirely sure understood what you said, Mike. And when you said that chopping wood and carrying water, I mean, people would not have heard that as a kind of the chopping wood and carrying water would stand for all kind of physical activities. I mean, you could equally have said planting rice and pulling weeds or something. I mean, mm-hmm. it would have had the same meant the same, really, wouldn't it? I mean.
If somebody had said it,
yeah.
I'd have no idea whether it would have meant the same. But it could have meant the same. It's possible that it could mean the same.
Well, people would have heard it as the same, and people who didn't necessarily.
Well, if they'd heard both, they would say it was the same. If they only heard one, it would be another one to be the same as.
Yeah, but people who. I mean, you don't think people would have, yeah, would have heard that. I mean, I heard it. It's just everyday physical action, activity. What you actually do, what is in front
yes.
of you, is the essence of Buddhism.
Yes.
Chopping wood and carrying water. There are many, many other things.
Well, everyday physical activity. We've already generalised what the story is chopping wood, carrying water, which is not a generalisation. We want to generalise it, so we say, "Oh, I got it." So it's everyday activity, and then we say, so it could be that, and it could be that. All I'm saying is, all I meant to say was that there are everyday activities, but there are qualitative differences in what we do. It's not theoretical. Do them in your life, and you will find that doing emails every day has a different effect on you than chopping wood and carrying water every day, or walking around in circles every day, or operating on a patient every day. So our real experiences are qualitatively different. So some of our real actions seem to be loaded intellectually. They give us the freedom to be very abstract. And typing an email is one of those. Because if you're a touch typist, you don't even need to do anything. Your fingers are doing it. So all your effort is
in your head.
Putting it down. How much it's qualitatively different, I wouldn't say. Whereas something like chopping wood and carrying water is qualitatively different in my experience. So for instance, if I go for a walk in the forest, it's qualitatively different to if I stay at home and edit scientific papers. It has a different effect on me as well. So what I do is I try and do those things which have an effect on me, which I feel is balancing, with those activities that have an effect on me, which I feel stresses me out. And I think that's generally what we all do.
Yes.
So that there are, we can generalise and say, oh, they're all actions, they're all everyday actions. Yes, they are, but they don't all actually, when we do them, we know that, notice, they don't all have the same effect.
It's the way that we carry them out. Like, it's not just the way that we carry them out matters as well. So I've
no, I'm not saying anything like that. I'm just saying they are different.
Yeah, definitely. But when you say, you know, when you talk about some, there are some activities such as sending emails, and you use the phrase one of those. Is that not, when you say of one of those,
yeah,
are you not
generalizing,
implying one of those in that category?
Yeah, because I can send give you another one, receiving emails and reading them.
Right. So
or
we're now into category
browsing the web. So all those, to me, in my experience, all those browsing the web, looking at Facebook, sending emails, receiving emails, are all based on the computer. And for me, the only there's a feedback loop when I play with the computer. It's my fingers, my eyes, and it goes round and round and round. And if I do it, it winds me up slowly. so I have to stop and do something else. So that's, in my experience, that's one qualitative group. I'm generalising already, aren't I? And another qualitative group is going for a walk, chopping wood, cooking, you know, those kind of things.
So there is nothing inherently wrong about generalising and categorising things, as long as you understand the
yes.
way of doing
yes.
that, basically, and not,
yes.
not sort of...
All I'm pointing out is they're different. That's all. That's what I was trying to say, is they're different. The actual actions that we're talking about are different. That was all I was saying.
And the effect that they have on us.
The effect that they have on us.
So there's also the aspect of you saying that the essence of Buddhism is chopping wood and carrying water, is that...
Yeah.
I'm just imagining being a sort of, you know, the 10th century wood chopper in Japan. That's what I did all day.
Yes.
And, you know, being a bit fed up with it. And wishing to do something else, and which is, you know, and... but then some sort of priest or something said, well, you know, if you say the Buddha's name 10,000 times and
yeah.
give off your wood to the temple and do meritorious things, you'll have a better life.
Yeah.
Which is probably, you know, religions, all times and all places have said variations of that, you know. But I think actually, you know, someone saying that this is life itself, you know, what you're doing is the essence of life itself. It's quite stark and quite radical, though.
Mm.
I think quite hard to hear, really. I think I was being a bit flippant, kind of, you know, in a way, sort of saying it's, cause it obviously is very different from the working life of a medieval peasant is obviously not very comparable to what I do, but there is still that aspect of sort of lying in bed in the morning wishing you didn't have to do it, I guess.
Is one of the dangers of generalisation, though, and abstraction, that it becomes so habitual and powerful that we overlook the value of difference and uniqueness in our experience? I mean,
sure.
For example, you sit on a cushion and stare at a wall, and if you're caught by the abstraction, zazen, and the generalisation of your associations with that practice, you might easily overlook the quality of that particular sitting on that particular day, and so on. You know, in other words, to notice what's right under our noses, there's a sensitivity involved, isn't
yeah.
there?
Yeah.
You know, like walking through the woods, any old wood, oh, this is just a walk through the woods, so I won't notice this wood at this time, on this day, and so on.
Mm.
I can give you an example from my personal experience. When we just started this retreat, I mentioned to Mike and to some other people that I haven't been sitting on a cushion for a while, for the simple reason because I've been sitting too much.
Mm-hmm.
So I generalize sitting and sitting. Because I'm sitting at work, I'm sitting while studying, and I thought sitting on the cushion is surplus to requirement, too much. So that's sort
yeah.
of wrong generalization, yeah?
Mm.
And only by experiencing sitting on a cushion for a prolonged period of time, I realized that no, they're actually from different categories of English, you know. Sitting is different from sitting.
Mm.
So that would be wrong categorization, danger of wrong labeling.
Mm.
And it's very powerful.
Yeah.
Isn't it, this aspect of our minds? You
yeah.
mentioned it before.
It's very
Mike.
Easy to make this mistake, just like, you know, I'm making living by sending a mail, so that's what I do for living. So as long as I do it well, I don't need to go out and chop the wood. Oops, maybe you do. Because it's different. And also the thing which sort of came to my mind from some research I read somewhere that children in school were intentionally made to move more.
To what?
To move more. To move.
Okay.
To do more physical activities, exercises, and I don't know how, but they somehow managed to measure the energy they spent.
Mm.
Yeah, and compare to children who moved less. I don't know how it was monitored. I don't remember the details of this research, but the striking conclusion they came to that overall children from both groups spent roughly the same amount of energy, because children who were moving more in the range way in the school came home and relaxed more, which out in front of TV did whatever they do, they fidgeted less. So they didn't spend more energy because they were made to do exercises at school. They just saved this energy elsewhere. They balanced it. And the other group who were passive at school came home and ran around and did some activities, also balancing liking exercise at school. So as a child, they did it intuitively.
Well,
balance
is a concept, but it's a very, very powerful. It's a generalization.
Yeah.
But it's very powerful, isn't it? Because balance is in everything.
Yeah.
Homeostasis is balance.
But I mean, if you allow yourself to hear, to listen to your needs, maybe you would know better when it's time to chop open, fetch water. Instead of anywhere else, I don't know.
Listen to yourself. Listen to your needs.
And there might be a time, you know, it's not like things are inherently good or bad, right? You know,
if you
spent 15 hours chopping wood all day,
yeah,
and sending an email,
you need,
it's
you
not
need
going to kill
to,
you, right?
Yeah.
And I think that probably the main issue is what happens with emails and technologies, that they just do it far too much. And it's not. It's not that there's something inherently good or bad about it, it's just they just do it a bit too much, because they've been these things have been made to be a bit too exciting for us. I think I've noticed it myself when I sort of label, when I think this is good for me, this is bad for me, I think this, you know, if I sit then this will have a positive effect on me, and then you almost create an expectation. And
well, I could say, I will say this, and you can then rip it to pieces. If we practice balance, zazen, or an activity that balances us, then our body-mind becomes balanced. Not perfectly, not the perfection balance that we have in our mind, but somehow balanced. And then it doesn't matter what we think about, what we plan, because most of our actions come from our unconscious rather than our consciousness. So if we practice zazen and balance ourselves, then our life we can follow a balanced way. We don't have to decide to. Lots of people say, how do you carry zazen over into your life? I mean, it's a favourite topic.
Mm.
Well, you don't, because it's already there. If you practice balance, then your body and mind is balanced. And if your body and mind is balanced, then your actions are balanced. It all sounds a bit too easy, doesn't it? That's what my teacher used to say. He said, just practice zazen and that's it.
Mm.
What? But 45 years later, I agree with him. So what I try and do is stop myself deciding what's good and bad for me. I can't help doing it, but I don't try and focus on it too much. Of course I do sometimes, but I don't try and focus it on too much, because my life is leading itself based on my practice of balance. It means I don't know where I'm going quite, But I never knew where I was going anyway, so... But I'm going there. So because I have come to believe that practicing balance makes you balanced, and if you're balanced, then you weave your way along, a bit left, bit right, bit up, bit down, but generally in a balanced way, then I'm going there, aren't I? So it's a very nice cop-out, really, from all the worrying, planning, evaluating what you did and what you should do and what you shouldn't do. But it sounds very simple. It sounds very simple as a principle, but it's quite difficult to live like that because it's scary, because it means you don't know quite where you're going. But none of us actually quite know where we're going. We just say that we do to make ourselves feel safe.
But it sort of, to me, makes Zazen a thing, as though, you know, I don't know, sitting on a cushion.
Yeah.
I don't know what the thing would be. Sitting on a cushion.
Yeah.
And if you just do, if you sit on a cushion.
Yeah.
Then you will be balanced.
Yeah.
That's what you're saying.
But if you practice Zazen, in a sense that I learned.
Mm-hmm.
Which is not just sitting on a cushion,
mm-hmm.
but it's adopting a posture,
mm-hmm.
not a static posture, but a dynamic posture.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. That's what I'm saying, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And we can try and explain why such an activity, such a posture will balance us. For instance, we can explain it in terms of the spine lengthening, the muscles dropping off their tensions, because most of the muscles in our back are deep, extensor muscles controlled by the autonomic nervous system. We don't have conscious control, but if we sit in this posture, not fixed, but dynamic, And our muscles drop off the tension. The nerves that come out between the vertebrae are not pressured. There's no pressure on them, because if you put pressure on a nerve sheath, then the signals that are going up and down the nerve are affected. So if you sit like that every day, you know, as a habit, then all the nerves aren't coming out one side of your spine are being pinched, and all the nerves coming out the other side are not. So that, over time, will have an effect on your whole physiology, on your heart rate, on your indigestion, on everything. So to sit in a balanced way, this is just an explanation, has a physical effect on the nervous system. So it's not just sitting on a cushion.
No, of course not. But does it imply that it doesn't matter what you do with your mind? Because
yes.
Sitting upright will eventually come to mind.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. And anyway, we say what you're doing with your mind, but that's not really what the situation is at all. When we're sitting in Zazen, sometimes we're consumed by thought, and then suddenly we realize, and that instant of realization, we've stopped. So then we're not consumed by thought, and then suddenly we're consumed by thought. So it's rather a digital process. So there's not two people in there, you know, one's thinking, the other one's trying to stop the other one thinking, and all that. That's only the way we talk about it, because we don't have any other way to talk about it.
And Dogen describes it, doesn't he, a lot in the show, again, so this nature of Zazen. Am I right? In different chapters, describes what you're just saying.
Yeah, in very poetic terms.
Yeah.
Like he says, if you sit upright, you sit with the whole universe sits with you, and all the trees, and you know, it's wonderful stuff. But he's trying in the 13th century to describe something that he didn't have any ability to describe in physiological terms, for example. And he described it how he felt it. So he describes a feeling of wholeness or oneness in terms of the whole universe sitting with us. So yeah, doesn't it's not exactly a thing. We could say it's a thing if we abstract it, but mm-hmm. it's actually a practice. It's an activity, and it's powerful.
Feels very different today, sitting. You know, the settling down thing that you talked about at the beginning. You can feel it happening. Completely
yeah.
different sensation sitting today.
Yes.
You know, all the baggage, so much of the baggage that I brought in with me has just dropped away. You know, preoccupations,
and that's just a lot of
tensions.
Floor,
you know, all the stuff we've been talking about.
Yeah.
Has just dropped away. But I didn't sit there intending for it to drop away, because I can't do that.
No.
I can't say, stop thinking about such and such and so and so, because
no.
automatically what happens is I'm thinking about not thinking about it.
Yes.
So it's just the practice itself
yes.
that sustains.
Yes. The practice itself is both physical and mental.
Yeah.
It's not, there's no separation.
And it's terribly difficult talking to other Buddhists about this. You know, what about the fullness and the right that, you know, and all the and the special this, and, you know, the whole list of things which they do in their practice. And I always find myself speechless about that. I can't really sort of say anything particularly interesting or tempting.
We don't have to.
No, you don't. Well, you can't, can you?
No.
Sitting down, staring at a wall, you know. Yeah, that's what it is, yeah. In a balanced way. No,
no. I can see the advertising campaign.
and their practices aren't equally ridiculous.
I don't. It's not judging their. I just think it's impossible to kind of. You said it yesterday about sometimes it's easier when people come and sit with you who know nothing about Buddhism, and it's much harder when people come who've got a load of other information or practices in their experience.
Well, unconsciously, we tend to look for things that agree with the beliefs we already have, a bit.
Mm-hmm.
I can't tell you how much, but it feels much more comfortable to hear something that we can immediately agree with and accept than to hear something that we think, huh?
Mm.
So we tend to prefer to hear things that we can agree with. Yes, yes.
Do you think there's some potential can of worms, but in our practice we've been kind of thinking about free will and how it seems that the on practice, you just kind of just sit and just don't really decide to. We're not stirring the water. You're just sitting there, and the practice has its effect. When you're teaching, you are a block of wood. And when we practice, we're not consciously deciding to do this or this. There's a right way of doing Zazen, which we will do. And it seems my ability to sort of quieten down is not something I do. I choose to do as such. It's just something that happens. I don't know where the kind of free will comes into it.
You've decided to say it.
But that decision itself, do I decide to sit?
Does it matter?
Well, no, it's just quite interesting that you say you just live your life and you're sitting zazen and you realise that you don't have that much control over your, you don't really have control over your future. You think you might do, but it's just a kind of safety blanket. And it seems to me that it.
Are you paraphrasing what I said, or are you saying something different?
Possibly incorrectly paraphrasing what you said.
Yeah, incorrect. Yeah, very incorrect. Yes.
I thought you said that you just practice zazen.
And my life lives me, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
So if you stop interfering in your life, your life will live itself.
Mm.
It is, you are living yourself. You are living your life. But we can't stop interfering.
Mm.
Putting our finger in the glass, stirring it. So to stop interfering is scary.
Mm.
Because one reason we interfere is because we're afraid.
Of the unknown, of the new.
Unknown, yeah.
Yeah, of the unexpected, yeah.
Failure.
Yeah.
If there was some principle, it would be very easy to fix your zazen and decide how best to calm down. If you decide how to calm down, if there was some principle out there, it would be very easy to fix it. But there's, I don't know which of the 301 koans you should read today to fix yourself. Because they're just examples of stories, you know. They're not one principle of right way to grow and right way to live your life. Right?
Well, the kind stories are kind of illustrations.
Yeah, but how do you know which one to tell us right now? If I'm stupid...
Well, read them all, then you're covering your bets, really, aren't you?
But that's the frustration with not having any rules. That is that is illustrations of something which is.
There is a rule. Our rule is no rules.
Well, our rule is balance. The balance is good. That's the rule that is sort of.
Yeah, but we can't get balance intentionally. That's that's the thing. Any more than if you want to walk along a tightrope, you can intentionally make yourself balanced. It's a complete. Whole activity, slack line walking,
mm-hmm.
as is riding a bike.
Mm-hmm.
But very often the koans bring us back to a very simple reality, don't they? I mean, if one's looking at generalizations, very often the monk or the student is kind of puzzling over something complicated, and the master is saying the tree at the bottom of the garden, or the fish at the, pointing to something very concrete.
Yes, I don't have the koans here, and my memory is so bad these days, I hate to quote any, but generally speaking, the koan stories illustrate how when we ask a question to some kind of teacher or somebody who we believe that can help us by answering, our question tends to be intellectual or abstract. So then the person we're asking if they're wise, whatever that means, replies in a more concrete way.
Like you did about the chopping wood, you know, the one activity is very intellectual and in your head and your fingertips.
Yes.
The other activity is very concrete.
Yes.
With splitting fibrous structure with a steel wedge, really, isn't it? It's a totally different kettle of fish.
But that was not the answer.
Same with the images there, Mark.
That was not the answer at all. That was your question, but it was not the answer.
But you were bringing us to something concrete and specific in comparison to something abstract and very intellectual, which is sending emails, writing emails. You're manipulating language, you're using little black squiggles to communicate words and ideas. It's an entirely different activity to going wallop with a solid great lump of steel.
You've got it then, no?
I'm in the mood for chopping wood now, I've said that.
There's the wood. Your wit can be the axe.
But when you said about not interfering with your life and letting your life leave you, can you give a concrete example?
Yeah, kind of. I'm in the Czech Republic.
Yeah.
I've only been there 8 months. So I have a life there, and my life is carrying on there. But I often wake up with the feeling that I have to decide what I'm going to do. Now, even if I don't decide what I'm going to do, I do. I do this and I do that, I do that. So I have a kind of fear that if I don't sort out something, okay, now I've got to sort out something so my life is going to progress. But it's because I'm afraid of the unknown. So sometimes I realize that and I talk to myself, just live the day. It's okay, Mike, you're here, everything's okay, just live the day, and then I calm down.
So you're worried about Brexit and what it means, yeah?
No.
Yesterday.
Okay, yes.
That was my fault.
So if I allow myself to live the day is usually very satisfying. And if I'm worried or afraid or anxious that I should in some way start making my life in the Czech Republic, it makes my day unsatisfactory. So if I allow my life to unfold, if you like, then it works. So that's my
almost like moment by moment. You know, dealing with this, dealing with that, as it appears.
Yeah.
Instead of the great big plan.
Well, but it's not necessarily moment by moment, right? You can have plans. There's nothing wrong. You can have plan A and plan B, depending on where Brexit goes, right? There is nothing wrong.
There's more than two.
Well, I know. I'm only just giving you an example because
it's a really good example.
It happens to me. And so it's kind of nice training for me. Don't worry, you're living your life here, and just carry on. And it works. Once I give myself a stern talking to, which I do quite often.
There can be things that could really get in the way of that. I mean, if you have deep set psychological problems or stuff, I don't think Sazen really is going to fully really help deal with that, really. I mean, there's some things that stop you from
living
your life. I mean, for some people,
some
people's lives are just hell because of whatever reason they've come to in their life.
Yeah, so if you've got, you know, like if I've got some kind of psychological blockage, which means that although I give myself a talking to, still my anxiety is there, then I should really look at that with one of the with a therapist or somebody who I feel can help me. I can't zazen everything away.
It's because you still have to be responsible and make decisions to an extent, because you're still a person that lives in society.
Oh yes, I don't mean you.
I mean, you know,
Michael. Like you go, okay, Michael, this morning, just live your life.
Yeah.
No, not like that.
Yeah.
That means, you know, do the next thing.
Yeah.
If I feel heavy, I go for a walk. Mm. Or if I've got some work, start it. So just carry on with life, rather than worry about where I'm going. Don't worry about where you're going, because you're going. The next thing will take you there.
So you're not making any big plans at all, long term?
Well, I'm not, but I'm fortunate in that I can do that, and it doesn't have any effect on anybody. So I'm very fortunate. So I can make no plans at all. Yeah.